watch today is going to give us a thought on regional tectonic model and discovery methods of the mineralization at the Clementine Prospect in the northern Pioneer Mountains of southwest Montana.
Thank you, Stan. Can you hear me back there?
No.
Huh?
Let's see. Where's the... Wait a minute. Huh. I don't know where the button is turned on.
Do I need a microphone in the back? Caleb, can you hear me okay?
Oh, they call it a tech guy.
Yep. What's that?
If it's back here, said it would be helpful.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
No, it's not working.
Okay. It's not working.
Should be a red light. Okay, I'll just try to speak loudly.
Sorry about that.
First, I want to thank Stan for the invitation to be here, and also Peggy for organizing a really well-done meeting, and Caleb for helping edit these abstracts. And Lysette Hammer and Sonny Thornborough in the U.S. Forest Service, and Bob Kronholm was in the DEQ before. And then my colleagues in Clementine that include several Montana Tech graduates, Stan Coons and Doug Furstenow. Our prospect is located in southwest Montana here in Silver Bow County. And it's about 28 kilometers or 17 miles southwest of Butte here in the Fleecer Ridge area. It's in the Beaverhead Deer Lodge National Forest north of Wise River and the town of Divide. And standing on our claim block, we can look right into the East Continental Pit. Or if you go to Fred's grill, we can look out there and see the edge of the claim block too. I base this exploration trying to explain on a regional level why Butte and Bingham occur where they do. As somebody that was an underground geologist in Butte, you always wondered why this deposit formed where it did. And I think now we can come up with some ideas that constrain hypotheses about how that happened. And it had to do with the frontal thrust on the severe fold and thrust system. The Pioneer Mountains are shown here in red. It is a red band there. And we think soon after thrusting, igneous plutons ascended fault ramps within the hinge of the frontal anticline of this fold and thrust belt. The magmas ascended the footwall of the thrust and invariably encountered this thrust. They basically had no other option to actually hit that thrust. And Tom Calliclay proposed a crustal cross-section. This would be one looking north within a syncompressional pluton emplacement at the tops of these frontal ramps within hanging wall fault bend anticlines, assumed to create open space for magma ascent. And he thought that this applied to the Boulder and Pioneer batholiths. The idea was originally proposed by Smith, Smeeds and O'Neill in 1990, part of the USGS Boulder batholith project, which was a tremendous addition to understanding Montana geology. So the idea is that magmas come up these thrust ramps, inflate areas in the hanging wall where the pressure is lower. And what we know is the porphyry intrusions we see in this environment are way too small to be responsible for the level of chemical fractionation we see that gives rise to the ore concentrations. And so we think laccoliths in there are in fact the likely intrusive source, the ultimate source. And we propose here that the mineralization occurs within these anticlinal hinges of the frontal easternmost thrust, and that the ore deposits form by explosive hydrofracturing off the top of the dike systems stemming from the laccoliths. If we look at the data from the oil patch, besides much deeper drilling than we typically do in minerals and seismic work, A lot of detail is available that deals with these releasing bend pull apart traps for oil and gas, and decompression within the anticlinal cores may aid magma ascent and magmatic water saturation. So if we look now to the 2-degree sheet, the Dillon one published by Ruppel et al., and put on here these thrusts, this would be the basal one, and these are imbricate stacks of thrust sheets in basement down here in Dillon. There's basically a regional north-south trending anticlinarium. And what we see is if we go from Bannock to Argenta up through the Pioneers, with roughly a 7 kilometer spacing, these old mining districts disposed in there with a gap right on the north side of the Big Hole River. And that gap caught my attention as a place that might be underexplored. And working with my colleague Bruce Marsh in magma dynamics, we think that similar age magmas may have formed from equispaced Rayleigh-Talley diapiric instabilities fed off of a sheet-like magma in the thrust plane down there. And this would be equivalent to the 7 kilometer spacing we're seeing between some of these old districts. Another thing that we did with our exploration model is to superimpose on that geological pattern a map showing proposed wilderness areas in green, proposed recreational management and protection areas in purple, and timber suitable for open harvest in yellow, and paid a lot of attention to where along that trend there might be less environmentally sensitive regions that could preclude further exploration and mining. So if we now look at a piece of the 2-degree sheet, here is the Big Hole River Pluton. This anticline that was shown is the area that I've now mapped in detail. And using digital mapping systems with online GPS in real time. And what we're looking at here is a focused structural and reactive stratigraphic trap environment. And it's at a gap in the regionally spaced mining districts. Two distinct magmatic hydrothermal convective variants exist with respect to wall rocks and structure. If we think about Butte, the pre-main stage volume there is almost certainly a free convection in a hydrofract environment in the Butte granite, you know, with circulation sort of unimpeded within that. In contrast, if we look at Bingham and we look at the environment at Clementine as analogies, it's different. In the Bingham Canyon deposit, the Yampa and Highland Boy limestones were mineralized to make skarns. And at Clementine, my mapping shows that within the Kootenai and Blackleaf Cretaceous age deposits, we had a much more of a confined aquifer type flow with possible superheating and supersaturation causing orbicular wall rock alteration in limestone beds that look a lot like they do in the Yampa and Highland Boy in Bingham. The environment I work in out there is almost always under tree cover. A lot of places the rock exposure is really minimal. I do a lot with tree root heave, and by having the ability to map accurately to within maybe 4 to 5 meters air on the outside, by mapping these blocks like that, you can piece together quite a good inferred contact between these different formations. And I use a Fujitsu pen tablet for this and software we wrote ourselves. So the map that really helped us find this deposit shown here is a regional anticline. On the 2-degree sheet, they show a huge mass of Madison limestone in here, when in fact there's just a few places right along the crest of the anticline where we can find Madison. And away from the axial plane, we go into Pennsylvania quadrant, up section into Permian Phosphoria, Triassic Dinwoody, Cretaceous Kootenai, and Cretaceous Blackleaf, and we've mapped here sill bodies of the hornblende gabbro, very much like you see Way to the West mapped in the Wise River Quadrangle by Fraser and Waldop, the USGS. Along this axial plane is where our main target was, And the first thing we found was this huge object shown here in sort of flesh tones right there. That's a region that has large tabular bodies of this type of breccia, matrix-supported, almost pure silica breccia made out of fragments, I think, of the quadrant. So it runs about 98% silica. And then in this part of that body are tabular breccias shown here that are class-supported. And we think that what that represents is a mineralized matrix breccia, which are Gaussians of hydrothermal veins. And then way on both flanks of the anticline are these zones shown in that pattern here. These are the orbicular alteration zones. We'll look at those in details in a moment. Some of those have disseminated chalcopyrite in different places. A few places we see supergene chalcocite and covalite rims on the chalcopyrite. These are two new plutons we mapped in here. This one's really fresh. It has hornblende biotite. The sphene's still fresh in it, so it hasn't had potassic alteration. This one's got sericitic alteration. There's one mapped fault in here, has subhorizontal silicon sides on it. That particular fault dips to the east. And then here is the very tip of the Big Hole River pluton right here. Some dimensions on here. This orbicular zone here is at least 3 kilometers long. Between those two orbicular zones is 2 kilometers. So this is a big hydrothermal footprint. We think this is the outside of the hydrothermal alteration pattern. And it's equivalent to the Butte main stage and the Anaconda dome. So it's a potentially a large system underneath this. This is what the westernmost orbicular zone looks like. It has disseminated chalcopyrite, pyrrhotite, and ilmenite. The orbicles here are lined with chlorite, at least where we've done X-ray diffraction on them. In Bingham, they're lined with actinolite. This may be retrograded, or it may have been chlorite that formed initially. We don't know. These orbicular zones have the same pathfinder suite of chemical elements. Tellurium, arsenic, bismuth, selenium, antimony, lead, and molybdenum that we see in the vein Gaussians and the soil samples. And from that, we conclude these orbicular zones are part of a single magmatic hydrothermal system as the outermost manifestation of alteration. Inside of them, basically, are hornfelses. On the east side of the anticline, the orbicles look a little bit differently. We still see the oxide rust around the orbital from pyrrhotite, ilmenite oxidation, both ferrous iron, that it diffuses out a bit and makes these red rings. But on this side of the anticline, the orbicles are lined with biotite and muscovite. And we don't know if that's a thermal effect due to the granitic stock on the east side or not, but we still see disseminated chalcopyrite and pyrrhotite here. And it's biotite muscovite rather than chlorite and muscovite. So if I make a cross-section and try to explain how we get these vein breccias, here's an attempt to do that in PowerPoint. We think this type of folding is around a neutral surface of beds with contrasting competence with an outer arc that's under a state of tension and an inner arc that's in a state of compression. Basically, the quadrant on the outside, Madison, Amson on the inside, and along that surface, sigma 1 and sigma 2 are equal. Here, sigma 1 is positive in tension, and we think these vein, the big breccia bodies, the barren quartz ones we see, formed first here in the crest, and as strain continued, inner fragment milling and cascading went on, such that when the strain was higher, we formed the big barren breccia bodies like that in the quadrant. And that's what those breccias look like. But as magma, we think, from depth came in and released hydrothermal fluids, we formed hydrothermal sulfide matrix class-supported breccias shown here in red that look like that. And these are the ones that are just full of transition metals. And then on the inside of that arc, we'd expect to see compressional conjugate shear veins. What's kind of interesting is if we look at the Madison, there's a potential to find paleocarst here the top of the Mission Canyon. In fact, if you go to the south along the Big Hole River and look north, that there's a big anticlinarium you see in Dewey. We think those are paleo aquifers in there in karst environments in the Mission Canyon with enlarged joints, caves, and developed on a mature landscape that we think at depth could have a potential for a Cordilleran polymetallic vein and mantos potential. Now, our mapping last summer went really, really well because we started mapping limonites in these Gossens that go up to about 35% iron, but we started finding limonites that contain copper in them, which is kind of unusual. And those are live limonites, and a real useful tool was an Olympus handheld XRF unit that we would analyze our samples with every night and then send them off for assay, but we could still be doing the semi-quantitative analysis in the lab. And that's how we started recognizing this live limonite. And in terms of the amount of pyrite relative to supergene chalcocite, if you have a lot of pyrite, you tend to either make jarosite or goethite over here, but when you have a less pyritic protor, you tend to get hematite, and we think that's what we're looking at here in the case of this live limonite. This is from work Charlie Alpers and I did on the Escondida porphyry in Chile. So if we look at the northern end of those veins, we see these are the sample sites for the pieces of Gossen, the little plus signs. To the north, we see large amounts of tungsten in there, up to 0.3 weight percent. And these are relief maps showing tungsten, showing antimony, gallium, germanium, arsenic enriched up there too. And in the case of antimony, tungsten, gallium, and germanium, that drops off going south of the southern end of the vein system, whereas arsenic keeps elevated quantities here. So this is what these Gossens look like through the trees. In comparison, if we go now away from the Madison limestone, which we think was responsible for making that tungsten mineralization, and go south, here's where we see the product of the live limonite, where we get up to about 900 ppm copper in those vein Gossens, and that's nearer those felsic plutons that we see. We don't know that those are the parent intrusions, but they just happen to be right there. And so if we look at the other elements in this region away from the Madison, we see elevated silver, gold, molybdenum, zinc, lead, tellurium, and arsenic. And we think that's our porphyry copper geochemical signal. So if we go back to the map here and look at these veins, there's two elements in sort of a gradient in the chemistry of these veins. To the north, they are related to mantos, related to the Madison limestone up here and neutralizing these acids and actually dumping down tungsten there, whereas on the southern end, where the limonites indicate copper at depth, we think that's much more of an indicator of a porphyry copper target at depth here. Those are those two plutons I just referred to in yellow. Okay, we started pilot drilling, did one short hole, and we recognized within the quadrant a veinlet stockwork, which was very encouraging. These greenish zones have not been oxidized, they're just chock full of pyrite crystals that if we put them on an SEM, they have zoning in there with arsenopyrite, and then around the outer edges are a host of copper, arsenic, antimony sulfides. And that was really important for us to find, because when you see the geochemical signal we have, there's a number of different kinds of ore deposits it could be, but that allowed us to basically confirmed that it was not a yellow pine arsenopyrite mercury gold deposit, but in fact it was much more of a copper system at depth. And then we saw from these hydrofracture systems that there had been some type of explosive fracturing going on, which was really heartening. So we interpret the vein mineralization and surrounding orbicular alteration as a possible top of a zone porphyry copper system with metalloids, likely amenable to 21st century underground mining that would minimize surface disturbance. And that was the target we were trying to find. You may wonder why we were so focused on these orbicular zones, and the reason is that when you're looking for a porphyry target, unless you get really lucky and somehow land right in the middle of it, you're going to come in from the sides, and that's the first thing we found around the edges. And so that was our first indication that we might be in an interesting magmatic hydrothermal environment. So in closing, this is a map of the center part of this district, which we think is much, much bigger than that. These are the trace of these reconstructed Bain-Gossan systems that have tungsten up here near the Madison limestone. Lose that as you go towards the Plutons into a much more porphyry copper environment away from this polymetallic zone with tungsten. This was found with digital mapping on foot under total tree cover. That's right there is about 3 years of mapping out here, just making a little headway every day. What made it work was our search pattern was guided by the map pattern. Our evolving map pattern on the tablet helped us figure out where to go next. It just wasn't a random walk in the woods. And there's no way we could have done this without a GPS and a digital mapping system. I think that's why this wasn't found before. It's within a syntectonic thrust fault bend anticline hinge trap, which was part of our model. The anticline plunges north here. The axis, we think, is probably subhorizontal here all the way down to the Big Hole River. It may plunge south because at the lower elevation at the top of the Mission Canyon there. So it's probably doubly plunging on a regional sense, steeper plunging on the north. The copper limonite, using the handheld XRF machine, turned out to be a very useful vectoring tool to help us search more intensely for outcrops, with knowing that we're going to find something useful. And then it was confirmed with assaying with a 40-element 4-acid digestion analysis package. From what we've seen of the alteration footprint, what we're looking for is a possible deep, even butte-sized question mark porphyry copper molybdenum target. And this project started in 2011, so it's 6 years to get to where we are now. So we don't progress very fast. Thank you for listening. Yes.
What's the relative size of the tellurium anomaly in this zone?
There's places where tellurium relative to crustal abundance is about 600 times. And we have soil samples across here that have tellurium the whole way, clear out to the biotite, out to the orbicular zone.
Well, are we talking 30 ppm tellurium or?
It's 300 times whatever, what is it, a 1 ppb crustal abundance, something
okay.
Like that. Yeah, so it's about 300 times maximum.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing to us is we see the same, pretty much the same rank of pathfinder elements in those veins as we do in the soil samples, as we do in the orbicular zone, which to us implies that it's one convective system that's moving all of those together. Yeah.
What's the texture of the felsic plutons?
The one to the south is just a beautifully pristine, equigranular monzonite. I haven't really done a lot of any careful analysis on it. It's got fresh hornblende biotite sphene, so it hasn't seen any potassic alteration. The one to the north is sericitized, and I don't know what it is, because there's just little pieces of it on the surface, and so until we drill, I couldn't really tell you much more.
Porphyritic?
No, it isn't porphyritic. Yeah, that's why I said they're just there. I don't think they're the host pluton. We're encouraged that we do see small stocks of about the radius that Bruce Marsh's magma dynamic modeling would predict. Yes?
Red lines are veins?
Yes.
Okay.
Vein Gossans.
Is
there any
indication of those striking dip?
There's none of them really big enough to get a striking dip on. They appear like big mounds of breccia that that most stick out of the earth about a foot. And you can't really tell anything about the dip. The way we know the pattern is we just map all of those. And so we can just map every one of those individually, and that pattern appears.
So they are silicified?
They're not really silicified. They go up to about 35 weight percent iron. It's most to the north, it's goethite, and on the south, it's mostly hematite. These are polymictic. There's different kinds of lithologies in there, whereas the barren ones that are 98% silica is just quartzite fragments in it. I don't see any other rock types in there. And I think what we're seeing there in the barren ones is the nascent brecciation going on at the crest. As folding continues, and the strain's pretty small, but as it increases, more fractures developed when the hydrothermal fluids came in, and the matrix was actually sulfide.
Do barren quartz rich ones have the same orientation?
Yeah, they have the same orientation. They're much bigger. There's places where they're 20 meters wide and they go for 50 meters. I think they were where the quadrant basically broke above that neutral surface. Yes? That's an excellent question, too. We're quite near Fleecer Ridge, so the kind of long-term thinking we have is if this was ever developed, we'd develop it from the east side and with an access tunnel coming in, so there'd be nothing going into that drainage going down Jerry Creek. So that's an excellent question. Yeah?
It looks to me like those veins and the breccia actually cross the axial surface of the fold. Is that
good point? They're close to it, in the context of the area that we've mapped, but they do cross cut it slightly. You know, they're slightly displaced from it. It's a good point.
And then these orbicular zones. So these guys go like this, or I guess from you they go like this. But the orbicular zones are kind of oblique to the breccia. Is that
well, in general, these pretty much strike north-south or 350 azimuth. The orbicular zones are about 10 degrees azimuth.
So they're very close.
Very close to it, yeah. Okay, thank you.
Absolutely fascinating.
Thank you.
I think there is something to this geology.